If you were reading or listening to the news this week, you might have heard about the State Department's Environmental Impact Statement report on the Keystone XL pipeline. If so, you probably think it gave its blessing for the pipeline to go forward. At least that's what most of the media seem to think. But the reality is much more complicated than that. In fact, the report raised some real questions that environmentalists will be using as ammunition in the continuing fight over whether Keystone will be built. I called up long-term environmental journalist John Cushman, now working with Inside Climate News, to explain. We only have time to play a small portion of the interview, but you'll find the rest at writersvoice.net. Now, the press has widely reported that the recent release of the State Department's Environmental Impact Statement on the Keystone XL pipeline would not have a significant environmental impact. Is that true?
Well, the report does not say that. It doesn't say it outright. And it's a simple question that doesn't really lend itself to a yes or no answer. The logic of the report was the same as the draft, and the draft report had language like that in it, but they were very careful to take that language out. And instead what they said is that a single pipeline or a single infrastructure project would be unlikely to have a major effect on the growth of production of tar sands in Canada or on the demand for that kind of fuel among refineries on the Texas Gulf. You can read into that what you like about greenhouse gas emissions, but the report actually does not come out and say that, and it does have some more nuanced messages about greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading on Inside Climate News, I was reading the Twitter feed on the issue, and it seemed like a lot of environmentalists were celebrating what the report said. And that surprised me because until I read that, the media story I'd been getting was that it was a defeat for environmentalists.
I would say the best that you can say right now is that the environmentalists continue to see a path forward in their crusade against the pipeline. They know that this report did not make a recommendation. They know that it is not the last step in the process. And they know that it contains some ammunition for them that they can take advantage of. At the same time, there's a lot of in this report that they view as very flawed, and they may have grounds for a lawsuit challenging the report under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. There's a lot of directions they can go. But they did manage to find, I would say, a silver lining. I think on balance, you have to say that this report was more favorable to the proponents of the pipeline than it was to the opponents, at least in the broad political campaign. When you get down in the nuts and bolts, this is a big, long, complicated report, and there's a lot of material in there for the two sides to use.
What were some of the things that we can find as ammunition against the pipeline?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. There's a line in the detailed chapter on the life cycle analysis of this fuel that says flat out that one of the clear conclusions that emerged from all the studies that they did is that if you approve the pipeline, it would raise the carbon footprint of transportation fuels burned in the United States. There's a complicated reason for saying that, but that's something that they can use. Another thing that they are hanging their hopes on is a section that says that at low prices for oil, it becomes more important to the tar sands operators to have the pipeline available, and that some projects in the tar sands would not be economical and might be abandoned if the pipelines were canceled in a setting of low oil prices. And although prices for oil are not that low today, they've been that low in the recent past, and it's hard to say whether they'll ever get that low again. Partly it depends on other policies. There are a lot of policies that the United States and the world might pursue as they attempt to keep the climate within safe boundaries that would severely restrict the demand for oil. In that kind of setting, the price of oil would go down and the tar sands would no longer be economical.
So you're talking, say, for example, a carbon tax or putting the price of carbon at something like $100?
Those are two examples, but let me put it somewhat differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important for the world not to build a large number of big, capital-intensive, permanent pieces of infrastructure which lock in carbon emissions. And this pipeline, whatever you might think about it, is a big, large infrastructure project that will lock in the emissions of the fuels that it carries for the next 50 years. And that's a lot of emissions. Now, this comes at a time when all the nations of the world are beginning to see that it's important to reduce their carbon emissions together. The United States has pledged to reduce them 17% in the next few years, 50% in the next couple of decades, and 80% by the middle of the century. And it's important to do that in order to escape dangerous global warming. This is the consensus of the IPCC and the other scientific mainstream analysts. Everybody from the World Bank to the International Monetary Fund to the Secretary General of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, to the Secretary General of the UN, the World Bank, everybody agrees that we have to move rapidly to a decarbonized economy to escape global warming. And for all these institutions to agree that that's the direction we're going into, it just makes it important to look for some large infrastructure projects that we don't build because they put us on the wrong path. And I think that's the argument that the environmentalists can find most persuasive, that, something's got to give. There is some evidence in this report to support that point of view. Whatever you think about whether the pipeline would encourage growth in the tar sands or not, the fuel that moves through that pipeline will have a carbon footprint. The carbon that comes from that fuel will add up to about 150 million tons a year. Over 50 years, that comes out to 7.5 billion tons of carbon. That's an amount of carbon greater than what the U.S. as a whole puts out in 1 year. It's an amount of carbon that's greater than all the carbon savings that we're getting from new regulations to increase fuel efficiency in cars. So there's little question that the fuel that moves through that pipeline is going to emit carbon. The argument here is over whether that fuel, if it doesn't move through this pipeline, is going to move through another pipeline, or is going to move by rail, or is going to go to another market like Asia or another market like Europe. And the economic analysis, the market analysis, that's a conventional business-as-usual analysis that the State Department hired contractors to produce for them, views the world oil market as being like a waterbed. And if you sit on one corner of it and the water goes down in that corner, it's just going to pop up someplace else. It views it almost as a force of nature that oil from the tar sands is going to be produced as long as there's money to be made up there. That's the Canadian perspective on this under the current Canadian government. But a sophisticated argument can look at some of the materials from this report and say, now it's Obama and Kerry's turn to analyze our national interest in whether we want this pipeline to move across our territory to our refineries and to be handled in this way. And that analysis goes beyond a business-as-usual case and includes our nation's broader objectives and all the other policies that the administration is pursuing and asks whether this policy is cohesive with the rest of the policy landscape.
That's a good segue into next question because, as you point out, the idea that the oil will be taken out of the ground is being treated as inevitable, as just a fact. But in fact, there's a huge and growing global and domestic movement to keep it in the ground.
Well, that's right. And there's ample evidence from the science and the economics that, you know, we know what our carbon budget is as a planet. We know how much carbon dioxide can be added to the atmosphere in the next 50 or 100 years. And still give us a chance, not a certainty, but a chance of staying within a reasonably safe amount of warming. These are ranges and risks. None of these numbers should be treated as being absolute numbers. It's complicated business to do the math. But directionally, we know what the answer is. And that is that there's only so much carbon dioxide. The oil and coal and natural gas industry already have enough proven reserves to fully meet that budget, and that basically 80% of it has to stay in the ground. This is a conclusion that's been supported by the International Energy Agency, which is the formal advisory body to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. These are the developed countries of the world, including the U.S. and Canada. And this is a very much an establishment view. It says most of the fossil fuels that we have to stay in the ground.
And
now, nobody's suggesting that Canada is ever going to produce all of the bitumen that they have in Alberta. That's a tremendous amount of very dirty fuel. But what's being asked is whether the amount that they're producing now is enough. Does it have to double in the next 10 years, triple in the next 30 years? And where does that degree of production fit in with Canada's obligations to the international community and with the United States' role in being, although not the biggest, still a leading and still a dominant producer of carbon emissions and consumer of fossil fuels?
Well, that leads into what you were talking about before when you said we don't want to put in the hard infrastructure because we may be very close to facing a situation where that's going to be, I guess, what they call stranded assets, you know?
Yes, that's you're on the right track. There's research that has been done, peer-reviewed research at the University of California at Davis, that asked the question, can we build any more infrastructure? And basically, the answer is that if we just stayed with the stuff that we've already built that produces CO2 emissions, that we would stay within its safe bounds if we never added anything. However, we're clearly not going to stop dead in our tracks. So you have choices to make. Now, the National Academy of Sciences, which for over a period of a couple of years looked very closely at this under rigorous peer reviews and public input standards, and this is the body which Congress has established to provide science advice to Congress and the government. And they came out with a report called America's Climate Choices. The very first line of that 2012 report said, certainly carbon dioxide added to the atmosphere presents risks, and every ton of carbon dioxide that's added increases those risks. And its core recommendation was to look very carefully at the kind of major new infrastructure that is being built so as to avoid making mistakes and locking in patterns that are going to go against our best interest over 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
So Obama faces a choice here. He said before that he won't approve the pipeline if it adds to greenhouse gas emissions. Environmentalists can take some heart in the environmental impact statement, but many others are saying this statement gives him cover. I want to ask you about the role of the press here. If what we are hearing from the press is pretty much that it was a slam dunk for the proponents of the pipeline, this environmental impact statement, what impact does that have on the public conversation that's going to be brought to bear on Obama's decision?
Yeah, I don't agree that the consensus of the press has been so cut and dried. I know the Washington Post, my local town newspaper, and its analysis made very clear that this was leaving the door open to Obama to make a decision one way or another.
Hmm. The Times
there were in the early hours of this report, in the early minutes of the report, before people had a chance to fully absorb them, I think there was a knee-jerk reaction, but this is not in the mainstream press. This is on the web that you see this. The instant analysis was, well, the State Department is pretty much sticking to its guns here and saying that the pipeline doesn't make much difference.
That's the message that's getting out, because I heard on, you know, all the talk shows today, you know, On Point,
right,
and the Diane Rehm Show, the consensus is the environmental, that's a takeaway message I think the public is getting.
Yeah. The public often hears what it wants to hear or hears the information that's easiest to absorb. I mean, I suspect if you ask the public whether building this pipeline would be good for the economy, they would say yes.
Mm-hmm.
The report says it would add $3 billion in gross domestic product to a $16 trillion economy. That doesn't even move the needle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some things that aren't in this report. You know, this report makes no attempt to assign a social cost or a cost for damages to any of the carbon dioxide emissions associated with this project. It simply makes no attempt to do that. It makes no attempt to outline what the performance of the tar sands would be in a situation where the world was committed to keeping atmospheric levels of carbon dioxide below 450 parts per million. There was a brief discussion of that in the draft report, but it's not apparent in this report. So, you know, this report is thousands of pages long, and it's not a simple matter, and I'm very sympathetic to the press to their need to present it simply, and also to reflect that there are multiple points of view here about what the meaning of this was. Maybe the clearest thing is that the White House and the State Department, as they released the report, were adamant in saying that we have not made up our mind, and this report does not have a recommendation and does not constitute the final say. That doesn't mean that Obama's going to reject or approve the pipeline. It means that he and Kerry are going to give it a good, hard look. And, you know, John Kerry is a hawk on the climate. If he is going to make a decision consistent with his long-held views on climate change and global warming and the need for aggressive government action, he's not going to agree to this project lightly. It's not to predict how this is going to come out, but I think that, you know, my own reading, and that's all I can really vouch for, is that, you know, Jim Hansen, the atmospheric scientist, likes to say that if you build this pipeline, it's game over.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're not at game over at this point. I think we're still at game on.
Mm. Now, you've been an environmental reporter for many years. What advice would you give to reporters who are out there? And I don't mean just environmental reporters, because there are fewer and fewer of them. I mean, the New York Times, you know, cut its environmental reporting division out. Not to say that they don't still report on it, but as it's, there's no dedicated division there. What advice would you give to reporters? What's the best way that they can report on the climate? What do they need to do?
Well, I'm really not in a position to give advice, but let me just tell you what I like to do. My approach to this is to read into the record. When the draft environmental impact statement came out, the first thing I did was call the State Department and say, where's the docket room where I can come and read everybody's comments about this? And their answer was to say that they didn't release the comments. The public comments on this were not a matter of public record. Well, I knew that under the statute and regulations that was wrong, and so I filed a Freedom of Information Act request and demanded that these records be made public, and they were. Now, I can't say I read all 1.5 million comments that were filed on this report, but I read exhaustively into the record, and that's how I spent this whole weekend, reading deep into the not only into the market analysis, but into the underlying documents that support the market analysis and into the models that support the underlying document. I think that if you're on a search for the truth, it's very hard to do this. It's very meticulous work, and it takes a long time, and it can be unrewarding. But when you're working in a subject area where the science and the physical realities are at the core of the issue, you just have to put in the hours to educate yourself about the fine details. I think that as writers, your obligation is to be as rigorous as possible and, you know, making sure, first of all, that you understand it, and then to write in a way where you accept that it is possible to convey the truth in simple words that people can actually understand. And it's a tough slog, but that's the only way I know to go about it.
Oh, that's great advice. We've been talking about the climate environmental impact, but there are many other environmental impacts that are involved with the pipeline.
Yeah, one of the most interesting things here is that it was striking that there was a lot more press coverage to climate change than to the issue where this whole debate really started, which is the risk of a spill along the pipeline route. And there are some troubling issues in that regard. One is that we don't really have a spill response plan or an emergency response plan laid out in detail by TransCanada. And these are required under the Oil Pollution Act, but it looks like in this case they're leaning in the direction of letting TransCanada produce that plan later after construction already begins. And it's not clear how much public involvement or public comment there will be on that. this pipeline, although it was rerouted, still crosses sandhill geology and the Ogallala Aquifer, and the new tables that are produced in this study make it clear that some of the land it crosses out there is as fragile and as valuable as the land that they've routed around. There still remains a question that's before the courts in Nebraska as to whether the revisions to law that allowed this new route to be pushed through are constitutional. And so we're going to have to await a decision on that by a Nebraska court probably in March. And that might be a reason to withhold judgment on this plan, because if it turns out that this new route is deemed illegal, it would seem premature to go ahead and approve it. And then there is the question that's before the Inspector General of the State Department. The environmentalists objected to the selection of the contractor and said the contractor had not disclosed its ties to the oil industry and to TransCanada. Of course, I have no way of prejudging what the IG is going to say about that, but you probably want to let the IG have his say on this subject. This was raised in the...
You mean the contractor that actually wrote the environmental...
Right. The State Department Foreign Service officers don't have the knowledge to write a review like this, so they hire contractors. And the way it works is TransCanada, as the applicant, proposes a group of contractors that the State Department chooses among, and the contractors have to file affidavits about any conflict of interest that they might have. And the contractors typically come from a community of expertise that advises the energy industry and energy regulatory agencies on everything that they do. And so contractors like this will have had work for many oil companies. The environmentalists have asserted that this contractor's ties to TransCanada, direct or indirect, were too close and that it didn't disclose them properly. And so they sought a review of that, and that's being done by the independent inspector general of the State Department. And
let me clarify. You're saying that those who write this are actually chosen. The original pool of contractors comes from TransCanada itself, the company.
Well, not only that, but TransCanada actually pays for the work as the applicant. Just like if I'm building a house, I have to pay for all the survey work and all the work that goes along with it. People are surprised by this, but yes, as a matter of fact, that's true. And the applicant, presented an array of people, and the State Department chooses among them. The applicant was unlikely to select the Natural Resources Defense Council or the Sierra Club to do this work.
Or any environmentalists that might oppose the pipeline.
Indeed. And what they had to do was come up with somebody who could be viewed as a neutral party. And so the assertion by the industry, by the environmental groups, is that, they picked somebody who had actually worked directly or indirectly on other TransCanada projects. It's difficult to show that this contractor was in the pocket of the companies, and I don't expect the IG to find that. But the IG probably will have some criticisms, and we just have to wait and see what the IG's assessment of this is.
But the whole process just seems to embody a conflict of interest to begin with. Why isn't the State Department actually going out and getting some independent review, at least, of this review? Or is that in the cards?
Well, they've had a comment period, and so I myself have read hundreds of pages of advocacy review and argument and dispute over this. But in order to do this kind of work, you have to go to somebody who has experience doing this kind of work. Everybody who has experience doing this kind of work does this kind of work for the oil industry. Now, it is the case that this contractor who's in question, for example, is a member of the American Petroleum Institute, which is the lobbying arm of the oil industry and which supports the pipeline. And so there are some people who say, well, that's a disqualifying conflict of interest. to me, a disqualifying conflict of interest is, I don't want to judge this situation, but I would give you an example of a disqualifying conflict of interest. Susan Rice, who was the first nominee to succeed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, owned stock in TransCanada.
Yeah.
I think she would have had to recuse herself from the role that John Kerry is playing. Clearly, you can't own stock in the applicant and be involved in the process.
Right.
John Podesta, who is now the special counsel to President Obama in the White House, for a decade ran an advocacy organization that strongly opposed the pipeline, he has written that the pipeline is a bad idea. His views are well known on this subject. He's been funded by Tom Steyer, the billionaire who has been taking out ads against the contract, is organizing forces against the contract. So we know what John Podesta's position on this pipeline is. When he went over to the White House a few weeks ago, he said, "I'm not going to take part in this. My views are already well known, and anyway, we're late in the game." But they said that was not a conflict of interest, even though the climate portfolio at the White House is squarely in Podesta's lap. So, there are degrees of involvement and non-involvement in this review process, and it beggars the imagination to think that Podesta won't have his thumb on the scale in some degree as they make this decision. But does he have a conflict of interest? I don't know.
Well, you
now,
could say that
John
Kerry
is married to Teresa Hines Kerry, mm-hmm. who has an environmental advocacy foundation whose views on climate change and this kind of subject are very well known. I don't know that she's taken a position on the pipeline, but she has given the John Hines Award, has been awarded to at least a half dozen or a dozen scientists who have engaged themselves in their advocacy against the pipeline. Does this create a conflict of interest for Kerry?
I mean, it's
clearly it doesn't.
And of course, I mean, if you have a certain position, that's one thing. If you have stock in the company, that's another.
Yeah, and then if you have expertise, that's a third thing. The energy secretary came from MIT, where he ran the energy and climate program. Now, the group up at MIT and the people who work on this are, I don't think you could refer to them as pipeline opponents, and they are very much support the kind of all-of-the-above energy approach that some environmentalists find objectionable in the administration's policies. But I don't think anybody can call Moniz a biased or conflicted source. He just happens to be somebody who's spent his entire life in and out of the Energy Department, in and out of academia, and sometimes in the pay of industry groups, I imagine, immersed in these issues. So I think you have to be careful about what you consider the conflict of interest. Now, the folks at Friends of the Earth, and I respect their opinion on this, and they've done a lot of burrowing, and they may know much more about it than I do. They are adamant that this whole process stinks and that it should just be thrown out on the basis of who this contractor was. The only thing I'm saying is I think you probably want to at least take a look at what the IG finds about this before deciding what direction you're going to be led in by this environmental impact statement.
Okay.
And since the IG has looked into a similar charge before in the past and has not exactly delivered a scathing indictment, although he found problems, I think that in my view, it's unlikely that he's going to issue a death blow to the environmental impact statement. But he is an independent, statutorily independent IG, and his findings are not supposed to be swayed by the State Department or anyone else in the administration.
So now my final question. I just wonder if there was anything also in that environmental impact statement that looked at how the approval of a pipeline like this would basically continue a long-standing policy of favoring the fossil fuel industries. In other words, there's an opportunity cost. If you support something like this, it can send a signal that you're not going to be supporting, the robust transition to clean energy.
Yeah, I think this is where the next phase of the process, the national interest determination, plays its part. They can consider the national interest in whatever form or shape they want to define it, and they're really open to these kind of broad questions. As to the environmental impact statement itself, I would make a couple of comments. It's very odd that when you're asked to do an environmental impact statement of a decision to grant a permit to a project, that the whole thrust of the analysis is what would be the results if we denied the permit to the project, or if, in other words, if we did nothing. And this turns, in my view, and perhaps a simplistic view, but this turns the NEPA analysis upside down. You're supposed to be addressing the environmental impacts of the project that's in question, not saying, well, let's look in a mirror and imagine what would happen if we didn't do this project. Would anything be different? No, we don't think it would. Therefore, the project is benign. So that's just an odd way to look at it. Now, the second thing that I would say about this, under the NEPA law, you're required to do cumulative analysis. In other words, you can't just look at one project and in a vacuum, separated from all similar projects or from the totality of the problems that we face, analyze this as though it was just one minor thing. The emissions from the Keystone pipeline are a drop in the bucket compared to global emissions of carbon dioxide from all sources of man-made activities. The emissions from any single greenhouse gas emission are trivial compared to the gigantic effect of all of these things. So NEPA requires that you do cumulative analysis. And here you have, if you look at this cumulatively, then you see, well, the emissions from this project over 50 years are going to add up to as much as the United States gives off, you know, the whole country in 1 year. And so, and since carbon dioxide does build up in the atmosphere, it literally accumulates in the atmosphere, and it's the accumulation that causes global warming. And the accumulation of things that happen today will be felt for 100 or 200 years. You really need to pay attention to this. Well, the State Department actually has two pipeline applications under consideration right now. There's another application from Enbridge, and both of these applications are underway simultaneously. Nowhere in this report is there any attempt to say even these two things taken together are bigger than either one of them. And so the report says no single project is going to have any effect, but how about two projects? If you're allowed to take the rationale that is being taken in this report, then I'd have to say it would never be appropriate to stop any pipeline on the basis of its effects on greenhouse gas emissions. And therefore, to use the term, there was one oil industry executive who said, I'm for all pipelines everywhere. If you approve this one pipeline, you're declaring that you're for all pipelines everywhere. And if you're for all pipelines everywhere, then you're really not leading in a direction of turning around our carbon emissions and heading them radically downward to the point that you get to a zero carbon economy, like the head of the OECD has been recommending in speech after speech. And so I think that this failure to address the cumulative emissions in a serious way, that may be the Achilles heel of this whole analysis.
Wow, that's terrific. Thank you so much. I mean,
well, you're welcome. I'm glad to talk to you.
Yeah.
How's everything up in Amherst? Are you getting snow tonight?
Well, I used to be in Amherst. I've been living in New York, and we're getting lots and lots of snow. Yeah, I'm in Eastern Long Island. So.
So you're right in the main belt.
Also,
my in-laws are up in northern Jersey on the Palisades, and they're getting quite a bit today, too.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, you got cross-country skis?
I do, but I got new boots and they don't fit in my bindings, even though they're
Got to get that fixed. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Francesca. I'll talk to you again sometime.
This has been great. Yeah.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.